Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. When you're walking around, maybe in a park, the forest, or even the city, do you ever tune into the song of birds? Like, really tune in?
So you got some birds out there that, you know, produce one learned simple song, like a just like mm-hmm. that, right? And that's my song sparrow whistle. Then you have some other birds that can go. So they can produce lots of different varieties of song. They're both vocal learners, but one's more advanced than the other.
Eric Jarvis listens to birds as a way to understand how humans and other species learn language. Language is a complicated puzzle of processing information and imitating sounds. On today's episode, a look at how language works, how we learn it, and how language itself evolves and changes. That's Eric Jarvis whistling. He is a professor at the Rockefeller University in New York City and an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute.
I'm most interested in how the brain controls spoken language.
Eric looks at that in different species other than humans that also have language.
So to define what other animals have language, we really have to define what are the components of language.
Mm-hmm.
And we humans don't realize that there are multiple components that go into what we're doing right now, talking. Some of them are common throughout the animal kingdom, and some are rare. The common one is the ability to form new memories of sounds you hear and understand the meaning of those sounds, like a dog learning how to sit, hearing the human word sit. What's rare is the ability to produce that sound sit, to actually say it or even say whole sentences. And so only the species that have this vocal learning ability can do that.
Mm-hmm. So which species can do both?
It's us humans, the whales and dolphins, bats, elephants, five groups of mammals, and three groups of birds, that's songbirds, parrots, and hummingbirds, have the ability to produce the imitated sounds that one might call spoken language.
So they can hear sounds and then reproduce that sound.
That's right. And not only do they hear and reproduce, they can recombine them into new orders.
Eric says that one reason why humans and other creatures have evolved to having language is that we select for it. And a lot of species find talking kind of sexy.
All vocal learners produce learned sounds for mate attraction, but only some of them, like humans and parrots, will use it for other means. And so one idea is that in all of these vocal learning species, the male or the female that produced the most elaborate repertoire sounded the most intelligent, therefore the most sexy, and is selected for. And then that selection keeps that trait going and gets more and more advanced, and then eventually used for something else like we have for spoken language.
And what do you want to learn more about when it comes to this language, whether it's in birds or in humans or in other species?
Well, the first thing I want to learn is how is it happening? What's the mechanism in the brain that allows us to hear sounds, repeat them, and then form these long combinations of words? The second thing I'd like to know is how did it come about in a similar way between us humans and these other non-human animals that can learn how to imitate sounds? Even though there are differences between humans and these other species, and even amongst the other species, there's a lot of similarities in how they learn how to imitate sounds. We found similarities in the brain circuits, and we found similarities in the regulation of genes in those brain circuits between humans and these other species.
So give me an example of that. Maybe we'll start with the how is it happening. How do we do this? Like, if I'm a baby and I hear this language, and then eventually, without anybody telling me, like, here's how you do this, I learn how to also talk.
Yeah, so the how, as far as we know now, is that in the auditory pathway that all these species have, we first formed this auditory memory of the sounds we hear. So the baby hears mama, for example. Mm-hmm. And the baby can even understand those words before the baby can speak it. That's the auditory pathway, the perceptual pathway.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Then that information has to be transferred to the motor pathway that controls the voice, all right? Such that it tells the motor pathway how to pronounce the sounds, and the baby starts to babble and starts to then try to imitate the sounds after that and doesn't quite get it right. Goes, ma, ma, you know. And through practice, okay, hears itself and it said, oh, I got it wrong. Let me do it again. Got it wrong. Let me do it again. Again, over and over to try to get the sound, and one day goes mama, right? And so this sensory motor feedback, as we call it, the sensory is the hearing, and the motor is moving the muscles of the mouth and the tongue and the larynx. This sensory motor feedback is a loop in the brain that is the mechanism of how we do it.
And then it continues to grow. Like, I remember my pediatrician at some point when my daughter was, I forget how old, maybe 5 months, she said, oh, she should start forming the G sound. And I thought, really? Like, it's that precise? And then sure enough, a week later, she started going like, g-g-g-g, you know. So it's amazing how that progresses.
Yes, and apparently some sounds are harder to learn how to produce than others, so they tend to come later. But yes, it is amazing. To follow up on that, what is going on there that's different in the vocal learning species compared to the others is that all these other species do have the ability to perceive these sounds close to the way we do it, but not, of course, not the same. But they hear the sounds. They process it in their brain. But they don't have the circuit that produces the sounds or produces learned versions of those sounds. They can produce innate sounds from the brainstem regions, but up in the cortex, the forebrain, we humans, that baby, the songbirds, the parrots, have these specialized forebrain circuits that control the production of the new learned sounds.
This is what separates dogs from people from a language evolution perspective. Dogs are only able to produce their innate sounds, the barking, the whining. They don't learn barking by hearing other dogs bark and then suddenly barking in a new or different way.
What they do learn how to do with those innate sounds is learn to when to bark, what to bark for.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Bark for food, bark for attention, bark to go outside. You know, maybe even try to bark 4 times to go outside, 2 times for food. You can even teach dogs to do that. So we call that vocal usage learning, learning when to make a sound, whether it's innate or learned, as opposed to learning how to modify a sound, which would be vocal production learning.
Birds, like us, learn by listening to other birds' sounds and trying to replicate them, learning a whole variety of songs in their youth, with some variation even between species and regions. And do they take songs and patterns from other birds, or does it stay within the species?
Most species imitate sounds of their own species, and they're culturally mm-hmm. transmitting repertoires like we do for language through their own species, generation after generation. And you can get dialects in different geographic regions like you get different languages. But there's some species, like a mockingbird or an African gray parrot, that steal sounds from other species or steal it from the environment, even car horns and so forth.
What do we know about birds that imitate human speech? Why do they do that? Do they also imitate other birds and so on?
The general term we use for these species, including humans, are mimics.
Mm-hmm.
So these mimics that imitate other species also are the ones that can imitate human speech, like a lot of the parrots.
Is that really hard for birds? Because, I mean, they don't have the same apparatus as we do, right?
That's right. They actually have something called the syrinx. It's a different organ than the larynx, but it evolved in a convergent way. And some muscles in the vocal tract that they use. And there are limitations on the kind of sounds that the syrinx can produce. Just like there are limitations on the kind of sounds we humans with a larynx can produce. So no matter how good a vocal learning species we are, there's some sounds we're not going to produce because we just don't have the right muscles for it.
And what's hard for birds? Like if I think about a parrot talking, I'm thinking a parrot going like, Laura, Laura, or something like that. But I don't think of a parrot saying, hello, dear, how are you? That type of thing.
Oh, but you can get a parrot to say, hello, dear, how are you, though.
Really?
Yes. Oh, yes. One of my favorite parrots is Disco. You can go online and do some search and you'll find him. BBC also recorded him.
It's not easy, Babe Green. I am not a crook. My name is Disco.
A lot of times you don't understand the sentence structure, but Disco did produce combinations of words in appropriate context, which indicates that they know something about what they're doing.
Then a parakeet. What is it? A three-mouthed bird that talks. But that's not important right now.
Now, you mentioned something earlier about birds having specific patterns or something akin to dialects. Like, is that a regional thing? Like, does a bird from New York sound different from a bird that lives in Kentucky?
Yes. Yeah.
How so?
So whenever you have cultural transmission of information, as opposed to genetic transmission, cultural transmission is more flexible. Things can change. And so vocal learning is cultural, just like spoken language. So that if you are separated by a geographic barrier for many generations, like what happened to humans, like this then leads to English, French, Spanish, or Chinese, and so forth. Over time, the repertoire changes, just naturally changes in the population. And this is exactly what happens with songbirds and parrots, and hummingbirds as well. A northern mockingbird and a southern mockingbird will have different repertoires, or East versus West Coast.
Would you be able to hear that? Would you be able to go, oh yeah, that must be a West Coast?
Yeah. Actually, what surprised me was actually listening to some hummingbirds. I was doing a project in Brazil a number of years ago on hummingbird vocal learning. And at that time, not much was known about hummingbird vocal learning. Still not much is known, but it was less than it is now. And we were trying to demonstrate if a particular species is really a vocal learner, we should be able to go to different parts of Brazil at that time and hear different songs from the population. And this is exactly what happened. But the song that we heard, this particular, we call the Fanta Croa, a hummingbird, sang, I can instantly tell it was a species, but it was a totally different song, like 200 miles south from where we were in a place called Santa Teresa.
Huh. Do you remember what it sounded like?
Oh my goodness, it's hard for me to imitate a hummingbird because it's so high-pitched. But it's like, no, that's too, it's really, yeah,
like something,
yeah, there you go, yeah. That's how one sounded, right? So that was the rhythm of one. And the other one was like, in another location.
Before Eric Jarvis became a biologist traveling the world to listen to birds, he was a dancer.
Yes, I was training to become a dancer when I was in the High School of Performing Arts in New York City. But towards my senior year in high school, I had fallen in love with science by that time as well. And I was trying to make a decision, do I become a scientist or a dancer? And I had good opportunities for professional dance. But I listened to something in my head that my mother always said, do something that has a positive impact on society. And I felt I can do that better as a scientist than as a dancer.
But it turns out dance also relates to language development.
In 2009, there were some discoveries that only species that learn how to imitate sounds, like we do for spoken language, are the ones that can learn how to dance, can synchronize their body movements to a rhythmic beat of music. And so it turned out there is some relationship from the ability to imitate sounds to ability to synchronize your body to sounds.
That sounds so surprising and amazing. So only species that can imitate sounds can learn how to, quote, dance. And I guess
yes.
We're applying the term dance lightly here.
That's right, yeah. So only species that can learn how to imitate sounds are the ones that can learn how to dance. And what I mean by that is synchronize their body movements to rhythmic sounds of music.
How did that discovery come about, that those things were linked?
And so there was this parrot called Snowball, it's a cockatiel, that grew up with some young teenagers, and these teenagers liked to dance to the Backstreet Boys, and this parrot was watching them and observing them and actually copying them. And so, you know, they put it on YouTube and Snowball became famous. And some scientists who knew about this dogma that dancing to the rhythmic beat of music was unique to humans saw this parrot and got surprised. Wait a minute, this is not supposed to happen. So they went to the owners of Snowball and basically tested out, can they get Snowball to move to the rhythm of the beat? If they increase the beat timing or decrease it, and Snowball would follow the beat. So then somebody else went out and then tested other species, like elephants, who are vocal learners, and other birds and so forth. And they found that only the vocal learning species can do this.
And what do we think could be the relationship there?
I think it is that what we're doing right now, spoken language, requires a rapid integration of sounds that you hear and sounds that you produce. And the sounds you produce, you're using the muscles of your larynx and your tongue and your jaw. And so you need this rapid auditory hearing integration of movement output for the larynx. And somehow that mechanism contaminated the rest of the brain. And so now sounds you hear are influencing other muscle groups.
What do you hope to learn about this connection between language learning and dance?
So I like to know, in us humans and these other vocal learners, are there specialized connections that take sound from the ears and integrate them into the brain circuits that control the muscles of the body? And if those specialized connections and genes that control those connections, are they the same ones that gave rise to the spoken language circuit? And if that is true, it would suggest that the mechanism of learning how to dance came from language. And what's interesting about that is that some cultures, they don't distinguish a difference between dance and music. They're the same thing.
Eric Jarvis is a professor at the Rockefeller University and an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He's also the co-leader of the Vertebrate Genomes Project.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com. The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
So far, we heard about how we learn language and why some species have language while others don't. Now, let's take a look at what happens when language is disrupted. A couple of years ago, reporter Alana Gordon met a group of people who experienced difficulties speaking and expressing their thoughts following a stroke.
I know what I want to say, but it doesn't come out clearly.
One of them was Mike McGale.
I want to tell you so much, but I can't. I'm sorry, but I hear everything. I know what's going on around me, but I just can't respond to it as quickly as I used to.
Mike had had a stroke, a blood clot in the brain, a year and a half before this recording was made.
It's a tough thing. I started out with one word per day, like, I've, it's, God, Sorry, today's a bad day for me. Mm.
What Mike is dealing with is called aphasia, and it reveals a lot about how language works and doesn't. Let's listen back to Alana's report.
Aphasia can actually reveal a lot about how language works and how it doesn't. It's a condition that can manifest differently for different people, depending on the type of damage to the brain. So it can cause difficulties in reading, writing, speaking, comprehension, all these things that are so essential, but we may not notice on a day-to-day basis. But the thing is, aphasia is often misunderstood.
It affects language processing. It does not affect intelligence.
Karen Cohen is a speech language pathologist, and I met her and Mike and others at Moss Rehab's Aphasia Center in suburban Philadelphia.
And that's really important because the word that's used here is that when people with aphasia talk, other people think they're stupid. And that can be the perception.
No. Karen runs a weekly conversation group, and she and others are sitting around this long rectangular table in a bright room at the rehab center. The focus here is on building social connections and confidence and communication strategies for when the words just won't come or when they're all jumbled up.
I'm a retired microbiologist.
That's Richard Berman. He's 74, and he had a stroke 6 years ago. As a result, he struggled to say this word, microbiologist, his lifelong profession. But here, everyone encourages him to keep trying and to keep practicing, with the help of some lighthearted teasing.
We like to make him say it as much as we can because of the way his speech was affected for his stroke. Somebody else can say it and not have any trouble with it. But the strategy he actually uses is to say it one syllable at a time, and it comes out perfectly.
Microbiologist.
Yay.
She's fine.
This group is actually part of a growing shift in how aphasia is treated. But Mikan, science itself actually owes a lot to this condition, aphasia, for what it has revealed to us about language systems and the inner workings of the brain itself. Okay, let's cue up the neuroscientist.
Aphasia, in the setting of stroke, is actually one of the most important disorders in the history of neurology for establishing the idea that there is a relationship between different regions of the brain, different centers, and cognitive ability.
Roy Hamilton runs a lab for cognition and neural stimulation at the University of Pennsylvania. He says in the mid-1800s, a patient who became known as Tan completely shook the medical field.
And the reason he was referred to that as Tan was because after he had had his lesion in his brain, that was the sound that he primarily generated. Instead of coherent speeches, Tan, Tan.
So he would walk around being like, Tan, Tan?
Yeah, you would ask him questions. He would try to answer effortfully, frustratedly, and that's what he would produce, Tan.
When Tan died, the neurologist Pierre-Paul Broca studied his brain. And he saw that the left frontal area of Tan's brain was the part that was damaged. And what that told him, what that told us, is that for most people, language is localized in the brain in the front left hemisphere. It's an area that now bears Broca's name.
And we now often refer to patients who have this problem that predominantly involves the production of language as having a Broca's type aphasia.
This idea that certain parts of the brain are responsible for specific functions was really big at that time, and it's a concept that still continues. So you have damage to one part of your brain where language works, language is impaired, right?
Yeah, makes sense.
But there's more to it, because even when part of the brain that's responsible for language, let's say, is damaged, the brain can still recover language function. Right. So Roy says other parts of the brain may work to compensate for this and find alternate paths. Plus, language, it's not entirely siloed in just one part of the brain.
One of the big things that we now understand to be different is that the brain is not static in its function.
It has a plasticity, or neuroplasticity, to it. Roy and others can better observe this in the brain thanks to modern imaging, like fMRIs. He has studied dozens of people who've had strokes months and years later. And what he can see is that the brain is working around that damage. Parts of the right side of the brain light up.
In an effort to process and speak language.
Yeah. But now, Mikan, he wants to take it a step further. And that is the sound of what?
That's the sound of transcranial magnetic stimulation. That is the jostling of wrappings of wire inside this coil.
Roy fires up the electromagnetic stimulator machine that's in his lab.
I would describe them as about the size of a 1980s VCR.
This therapy, where you take magnetic pulses and focus it on the head that then stimulates certain parts of the brain, is actually approved as a targeted treatment for depression. But he wants to figure out how to use it to help stimulate the brain to activate language recovery. But before he can do that, Mikan, he has to figure out what are the properties of how the brain decides what alternate pathways to take, and then how effective those pathways really are.
Wow, that sounds super complicated.
I know. But there is a more urgent question, especially for those people who wind up at the aphasia center or maybe never make it there, which is this. How much time does the brain actually have to repair itself? Roy says the traditional thinking has been you kind of plateau after about 6 months after having something like a stroke. It is true that therapy is critical during that time, but
there is more evidence to suggest that in general, this arc of recovery is likely much longer than we think it is.
The brain continues to repair and recover language over time.
Well, I think speech-language pathologists have always known that.
Sharon Antonucci is director of Moss Rehab's Aphasia Center.
While there are no guarantees about where you will end up in your recovery, opportunities for rehabilitation and opportunities for improving and increasing communication skills are lifelong.
Sharon worries that people may stop getting therapy, and even worse, kind of give up 6 months after their stroke, because what they're often hearing from their doctor is that they won't get any better after that.
And that message seems to be fairly pervasive, and I think it's a message that is created due to lack of education and lack of experience.
She says the implications of this are huge, because social interaction is a critical part of the rehabilitation process. But losing that ability to communicate is incredibly isolating.
A piece of data that is going to be coming out soon suggests that 20% of people who are 6 months after stroke with aphasia report having no friends.
So if you look down somewhere around 10 lines, it says Jones was an indispensable, mysterious... Anybody have it?
A few doors down from Sharon's office, the conversation group transitions into a midday book club. Charlie Salbert volunteers to read a passage.
Fighting the shadow war along the watery borders between the Union and rebel territory.
He had a stroke 3 years ago. Initially, he says his daughters had to really push him to attend this group, because he was so scared about not being able to speak around others.
And his mastery of the river was so complete.
What do you think would have happened had you not come here?
I'd still be sitting in the house. I don't think my speech would be as good as it is now. And I think I'd be sitting home alone, just wondering what to do. Calculate the most propitious time.
For Charlie and others I talked to here, spaces like this are a lifeline. Because here, they're able to do something that's really hard to do outside. Finally complete their sentences, no matter how long that might take.
It may sound strange to you, but it's important that people understand that people with aphasia need time to finish their sentences. Don't interrupt them. I mean, that's the probably the worst thing you can do, because it's very not only demeaning, but it's, what's the word I'm looking for? Destructive to their confidence.
That story was reported by Alana Gordon in 2017. I checked in with researcher Roy Hamilton to get an update on his work, and he told me that he and his colleagues have discovered some new things about how the language system operates. They are currently in the middle of a large clinical trial to test if treatment with a combination of transcranial magnetic stimulation and behavioral language therapy can improve recovery in people with chronic post-stroke aphasia. The aphasia center that Alana visited took the conversation cafe, the book clubs, and other activities virtual during the pandemic to make sure that people wouldn't lose momentum in their recovery efforts.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about language. So far, we've heard about how we learn language and how we process it in the brain. Now, let's take a look at language itself and how it changes. The internet is altering the way we write and talk at record speeds. It's giving us new ways to express ourselves. And linguist Gretchen McCulloch keeps track of these developments.
One of my favorite things is Key Smash.
Okay, I'm lost. And when does one key smash? Sorry.
So people use Key Smash as a way of expressing, you know, I'm so overwhelmed with thoughts, excited or, you know, angry or have such a strong emotion that I'm just, you know, mashing on the keyboard. Oh my God, I can't believe it. That kind of thing.
Wow. And so I would literally, I have a keyboard in front of me right now, so I would seriously just like...
Just put all your fingers on there and just kind of go for it. But because people, yeah, there you go.
Okay.
For bonus points, you can do it in all caps, and that's a really strong emotion.
Oh, okay. I will try that. Gretchen is the author of Because Internet, Understanding the New Rules of Language. And she says there is much more than meets the eye, even in seemingly random things like key smashing.
People who are key smashing on a physical keyboard tend to key smash on the home row. So that's your kind of ASDF sequence. Whereas people who are key smashing on a phone tend to key smash towards the middle of the keyboard, the center of the keyboard in general. So that's a lot of like GHB sort of in the middle there. And so when you look at key smash, you can tell whether someone's doing it from their phone or from their keyboard. I did a very unscientific poll of people asking them about their key smash usages. And a lot of people told me that when they send key smash, they will either delete and re-key smash if it doesn't look like the right kind of random, like right kind of pseudo-random, or they'll adjust a few letters if it looks doesn't quite look the way other people's key smash looks like.
You gotta send that perfect key smash to your friends or pick the emoji that is most representative of your current mood.
On the one hand, we don't have tone of voice and gesture and stuff that we do in face-to-face or, you know, oral communication. And on the other hand, we do have these additional sorts of tools like emoji, creative respellings, you know, repeating letters, writing things in all caps, using creative uses of punctuation and things like that.
In her book, Gretchen investigates how exactly we use all of these tools to add more nuance to our online communications.
Which tones of voice, which gestures do these sort of correlate to? You know, it's easy to make a broad statement. It's harder to say, oh, when people use a period, sometimes they're using it to indicate a sort of falling intonation at the end of a sentence. And that's why sometimes a period gets interpreted as passive aggressive. So when you say something like, sounds good, it could have a bit of sort of tension there because of that falling intonation.
The internet has often been accused of leading to a paucity in language, you know, where people use fewer words and it's the spelling is bad and the grammar is bad and everything is bad and it's going to be idiocracy all around. But it seems like the internet could also lead to a new way of talking, right? And in us having more ways of expression.
One of the things I think is really exciting about communicating online is that we all have a lot more practice in terms of writing and in trying to get writing to do exactly what we want it to do. And that's not always the same thing as the goals of an English teacher or somebody who really invested in the sort of system of formal writing. Sometimes that's like, you know, you're a teenager and you're texting someone you have a crush on and you're really worried of coming off like the right amount of like casual and laid back and funny. You know, your goals are very different than, oh, you're trying to write an essay, but you still have goals and you're very concerned about your writing accomplishing those goals. Linguists know that language is always changing from every generation. You know, we don't talk like Shakespeare did. Shakespeare didn't talk like Chaucer. And so the process of language changing from one generation to the next is completely natural and would be happening regardless of the internet.
Do you think it's making our spoken language less formal, though, or you don't see that happening?
Well, I think formality is always kind of a spectrum and it's always kind of a moving target. You know, what we think of as formal changes in the same way that like what we think of as formal in terms of clothes changes, right? So, you know, in a previous generation, suits were considered relatively informal because they didn't have tails. These days, some people think of jeans as quite formal, even though they were very informal in another generation because they're, you know, they're fairly structured compared to sweatpants or athleisure. So, you know, it's possible that one day there'll be formal yoga pants, right? or formal sort of spandex pants. But that doesn't mean that a distinction between formality and informality will be lost. There'll be something else that'll be informal in that context. It's really useful to have this ability to make a distinction between formal and informal. You know, it makes sense to talk differently to your dog than to your boss. I don't think any, you know, I don't think any of us want to go in and like, who's a good boss? Do you want to give me a raise? I don't think any of us are really, really planning on doing that. So, you know, having a spectrum of language you can use differently in different environments lets you feel more relaxed when you're with your friends, lets you feel more kind of buttoned up when you're at the office. Like, all of these things are fine. But what actually constitutes formality or informality, that's a moving target.
And there's also the issue of how to translate some of our internet language into spoken language. Like, you tweeted about when you recorded your audiobook about, you know, how to say LOL. Is it LOL or is it LOL or, you know, so how do we do that?
It's an interesting sort of challenge because the kinds of things that are really efficient to produce in writing aren't necessarily efficient in speech and vice versa, you know? So in writing something like IDK for I don't know, that's very efficient. An acronym's very efficient. It doesn't actually take that much less time to say I don't know, IDK, they're both three syllables long. Mm-hmm. Whereas in speech, you can say something really efficiently like, oh, which also means I don't know. And yet, how do you write that down? You have to write like a whole paragraph of exposition of like, you know, you can make this sound in your throat that has different pitches that goes, oh. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they do cross-pollinate. Sometimes people do say IDK out loud because they want to mark themselves as being an internet-ish type person. So it's not just about pure clinical efficiency. It's also about indicating the type of person that you want to be.
So did you go with LOL or LOL?
What I actually did is I used both, and I decided to use LOL to refer to the lowercase one and LOL to refer to the uppercase one.
And the whole LOL thing is sort of weird to me because I don't know if I ever heard people say, huh, I'm laughing out loud in conversation ever before I saw that being used on the internet all the time. So that seems to have been kind of born on the internet somehow.
Yeah, LOL, unlike most of the other internet acronyms, you know, things like OMG, WTF, BTW, you know, by the way, is a phrase that lots of people say.
Yeah.
And so making it into an acronym is pretty common. LOL seems to be the main exception to that. You know, people didn't go around saying, you know, that sounds great, laughing out loud. They would literally just actually laugh out loud. But, I mean, you do also see people using ha 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 or something like that, which sort of represents that laughter in a more literal way.
That's so interesting, because I was just thinking about, you know, how our spoken language makes it into our internet communication, obviously. And then our internet communication and our internet expressions make it back into how we talk to each other. And I was recently observing one of my son's friends talk, and I thought, he talks in memes. Like, I can't quite, it was like, part like being a mime and part saying little words, but it was very clearly like he was talking in memes.
Yeah, and if you think of memes as sort of, they're an internet version of an in-joke or a pop cultural reference, and people have talked in in-jokes and pop cultural references and metaphors and references to things for a long time before the internet existed. You know, if you if you talk to somebody else of a certain generation, sometimes they'll talk in like quotes from The Simpsons or quotes from Monty Python or quotes from, you know, any of these sorts of pop culture staples that like you need to know how to say, like, I'll be back. And that's also a certain generation's memes in a certain way. That was true even before the internet. You know, there are ways of making pop culture references that an older generation is just not going to get.
Gretchen McCulloch is an internet linguist and the author of Because Internet, Understanding the New Rules of Language. She's also the co-host of the linguistics podcast Lingthusiasm. We're talking about language. Learning a new language can be a long and difficult process. I remember arriving in this country thinking my English is pretty good because, you know, I had studied it in high school for a bunch of years. And then I realized I was missing so many words and I had such a hard time understanding people. Since then, I haven't really tried to become fluent in another new language, but now there are all these apps that promise to make language learning faster and easier. Do they work? Reporter Isis Pacillo looked into it.
I come from a mixed family. I'm Chinese, Mexican, and Italian, but not fluent in any of the corresponding languages. During the pandemic, my mom, who is Chinese, and I challenged ourselves to learn an entirely new language. We picked Arabic on an app called Mango Languages.
What's the way to say the condition?
You repeat words, eventually phrases.
Okay, now try to say, how's it going?
Kaifa al-hal.
We've been making very little progress.
As-salama.
Ma'as-salama.
And I couldn't help but wonder if this could ever lead to fluency. So I decided to investigate. I have to ask, language apps, do they really work?
Well, yes, sort of.
That's Sean Lowen. He's a professor at Michigan State University, where he heads the Second Language Studies program. He did two small studies on the efficacy of language learning apps, one about Duolingo and one about another app called Babbel.
I mean, if you use them, you will learn some things. But I think there's two things to keep in mind. One, you have to be realistic about what you can learn. And then the other thing is, obviously, the more time you spend, the more you're going to learn.
People tend to improve their grammar and vocabulary, but don't make as much progress with conversational skills. But in a recent study on Babbel, Sean did find that 60% of participants showed improvement in understanding and answering questions on a spoken test. Stuff like, what do you do with your free time? Or, what does your best friend look like? The improvement was surprising to Sean because you don't get a chance to practice talking to another person in the app format. Instead, you focus more on vocabulary, repeating phrases, or filling in the blanks. There's also conjugation practice and rearranging sentences. Is that a good way to learn languages? I turn to Kara Morgan Short. She's a professor of Hispanic linguistics and psychology at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
So one way that we have at looking at language processing and
language acquisition is through a method called electrophysiology. We can actually measure your brain waves.
So they stick a cap on your head with a bunch of electrodes placed in it.
And these electrodes are actually able to pick up the electrical activity that's occurring in your brain related to language that you may be processing.
Researchers can then compare the activity between how native speakers process versus second language learners. The idea is the more similar the brain waves, the closer a learner is to fluency. In one of her experiments, Kara split learners into two groups. One received grammatical instruction before they began learning, and the other didn't. Both groups did really well on proficiency tests, but the learners who were not exposed to grammar were the ones who developed more native-like brain processing signals.
We know that in natural language or in our first language, we never use language in ways that are not meaningful. We never go around and conjugate verbs. We never say, I talk, you talk, he talks. We never use words or grammar in any decontextualized manner.
How do you say how?
Kaifa.
Kaifa.
Language apps are definitely not the same as being immersed in a language 24/7, like when you're a baby learning your first words, or when you live in a different country. Here's Sean Lowen again.
The frustrating thing about Duolingo is the sentences are often somewhat nonsensical. I remember when we were studying Turkish, we had sentences like, you know, the cat is drinking tea in March. And as a language researcher, I believe that using the language communicatively is the best way to learn it. So when you have stupid sentences like that, they don't really help you.
But language apps can be fun, and that's important for learning too. My friend Lauren Meese retired recently and has used her new free time to improve her Spanish. Babbel is her favorite online platform.
Like there was one called Rumores, and the subtitle was, Dicen que Victor tiene una amante. They say that Victor has a lover. And the whole thing was all this gossip flying about the office as to who the lover was. Was it the new secretary? Is it this? Is it that? And they used a lot of words like lies, mentiras. I just gobbled up that vocabulary.
Competition can also help. When studying Duolingo, Sean Lowen found the gamification aspect to be fun and motivating.
You know, you can level up, you get experience points. And so I think that's a really good way to keep people motivated. Like right now, I'm on a 29-day streak on Duolingo. And so it's stupid, but I'm really motivated to keep that streak going, right?
As for my own efforts to learn Arabic with my mom, we've realized we don't have the motivation to keep it up. But I've shifted to Spanish, Mandarin, and Cantonese. So we'll see how that goes.
Morning.
早上.
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 That's reporter Isis Pachillo trying to get better at Cantonese.
早上. 你好吗?
早上.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Hannah Fulmer is our intern. Sojourner Ahebe is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.